Okay, today what I'd like to talk about is what's known as the Intifada. Okay, the Intifada in Arabic is sort of like the uprising. So how did it happen? How did it start? December 6, 1987, an Israeli was stabbed to death while he was shopping in Gaza. Okay, Jews used to go into Gaza all the time to the marketplaces. This was normal, and he was stabbed. Now, one day later, four people in Jabalia refugee camp in Gaza were killed in a traffic accident by an Israeli car. Rumors then started spreading that this was a revenge attack against the Palestinians, and riots started breaking out, broke out in Jabalia on the morning of December 9th. And during the Israeli army trying to put down the riots, an Israeli soldier shot and killed a 17-year-old who was throwing a Molotov cocktail at the army. This just exacerbated an already volatile situation, and soon you had waves of unrest that engulfed the entire West Bank, Gaza, Yerushalayim, and as I said, this became known as the Intifada. Over the next week, rock throwing, block roads, burning tires reported throughout the West Bank and Gaza. By December 12, six Palestinians had died and 30 were injured in the violence. The following day, rioters threw a gasoline bomb at the United States Consulate in East Jerusalem. No one was hurt, but this is where it was going. Now, then you had more rumors spreading. You had rumors spreading that when Palestinians were arrested by the Israeli army, or they were injured and they were taken to hospitals near Tel Aviv, they were actually killed. Now, none of this ever happened, but this is what the rumors were. It didn't matter that a United Nations official said that these stories were untrue. The Palestinians believed what they wanted to, and it started getting more and more violent. Now, the Intifada, which was violent from the start, got increasingly more violent as the days continued. During the first 4 years of the Intifada, you had more than 3,600 Molotov cocktails that were thrown, not even talking about the rocks at cars, which would be in the tens of thousands. You had over 100 grenade attacks, 600 assaults with guns or explosives. And the violence was directed not just at soldiers, but at civilians alike. During this period, 16 Israeli civilians and 11 soldiers were killed, while over 1,400 civilians and 1,700 soldiers were injured. Now, what happened here also was interesting. The PLO was orchestrating it, but they all of a sudden they started getting a rival. In Gaza, you had this Islamic organization that was fundamentalist, and they started to claim that they were truly in charge of the Intifada, and this group later on became known as Hamas. So this was a violently anti-Semitic group, and now it's a matter of who is, a bigger hater of Israel between the PLO and Hamas. Now, what's interesting, if you were following this in Chutz La'aretz, is that no one was really reporting what needed to be reported. Reporters weren't allowed into the Palestinian areas. Instead, the Palestinians said, "Give us your cameras and we'll give you footage." And they filmed what they wanted to film. Everyone knew that there were fake stuff that was going on, what today we would call fake news, but they wanted to have reports. So, for example, it was reported by CBS News. They showed a kid in a hospital with all these tubes, and then later on, this 12-year-old kid, he died, and it was reported that this person was beaten to death. This 12-year-old was beaten to death by Israeli soldiers. This was then later carried by other networks. First was ABC, then it was NBC and CBS. Now, the story wasn't true at all. It turns out that the kid had been sick for over a year, had a cerebral hemorrhage, but they reported what they were told to report. As some of the reporters said, the same way we show up to every photo op that a president calls, we were showing up to this because people like to see pictures, people like to see violence, and therefore they came and reported whatever the Palestinians wanted them to report. There was no free press there. In Israel, you would get two sides of a picture. You'd have people that would be pro what the Israelis were doing and people that would be against what the Israelis were doing. In the Palestinian territories, no one was able to speak out against the Intifada, and therefore you had one picture and only the footage that they wanted you to have. If you happened to take pictures, there was cases that, if I remember correctly, it was an Italian film crew that showed that everything was staged and mock, and the whole thing looked as if it was supposed to be like a spontaneous uprising, but really it was carefully planned. When they aired that, so these reporters were banned from Israel. The Italian news station had to apologize that they went against the policy. So as I said, in the United States and all around the world, Israel was now being portrayed as Goliath against the Palestinian David. David has mere rocks that obviously can kill. People were killed. My own wife, when she was a passenger in a car, had a rock thrown at the window, and the window smashed, and she had to have, I think it was like 30 micro stitches in her ear. People who had rocks thrown at their cars swerved and fatally had fatal accidents. I personally had rocks thrown at my car several times, as did all of my neighbors. There were rocks, there were Molotov cocktails. This was what was going on. Now, the United States wanted to try to make some sort of peace. Ronald Reagan, this was already 1988, he's on his way out. He's a lame duck president. He didn't have to impress the Jewish voters. He's finishing his presidency, and he sends George Shultz, who at first is ignored by the PLO, but finally he gets Yasser Arafat to say the magic words. He says, doesn't do anything about it, but he says that the PLO will recognize Israel and renounce terrorism. And that was music to the United States ears. And from then on, they started now pushing Israel for concessions. Now, in the middle of all of this, you had the Gulf War. The Gulf War, Iraq invades Kuwait. America goes to defend Kuwait for their own personal interests. And Iraq says, if America comes in, we will bomb Israel. Why in the world there should be any correlation between the United States coming in and the bombing of Israel is clear, you know, is unclear, but it was absolute. When asked in a news conference in December 1990, when Secretary of State James Baker and Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz was having a news conference after they met, when Tariq Aziz was asked whether Iraq would attack Israel if the war started, he replied bluntly, yes, absolutely yes. And that is exactly what happened. The prime minister in Israel at this time was Yitzhak Shamir. Yitzhak Shamir was a hardline right-wing prime minister, and his intent was to protect the people of Israel. The Bush administration, President Bush the first, he felt that Israel had to stay out of any conflict in the Middle East. His opinion was that if Israel was with the Allies, the Arabs would not want to join. There were moderate Arab countries that were willing to join and certainly at least give airspace and bases for refueling of American army and air force. And Bush felt that if Israel joined, then they would no longer be part of this allied confederation against Iraq, who they felt threatened by as well. Now, it was very difficult for Israel to let someone else be in charge of their destiny. Israel always protected their own citizens. But over here, as difficult as it was, Shamir stood down. Okay, he had told Bush that he was going to go. Bush said, listen, I'm not going to give you the password. And if your pilots are up there and our pilots ask for the password and you don't know, there's going to be a dogfight. And then you have a problem. It's damned if you do, damned if you don't. Either Israeli pilots would be blown out of the air by American pilots or the opposite. Israel would then be firing on American pilots. How would that be portrayed in the United States when America ostensibly is now going and risking their lives, is the way Bush put it, to protect Israel, even though, as I said, their interest in getting into the war was to protect their interests in Kuwait and nothing to do with Israel. This is the way Bush was portraying it. Americans are risking their lives for Israel. How would it look if Israeli pilots blew up American pilots that were fighting against Iraq. So Shamir, as hard as it was for him, he stood down and was not going to, and Israel did not get involved in this war. It was a very difficult war for us to sit by and just like receive all the blows. Now, Saddam Hussein had threatened that not only would it attack Israel, but it would attack with chemical weapons. The United States had already foiled an attempt to smuggle in nuclear triggers into Iraq in 1990. British customs officers also had found tubes about to be loaded into an Iraqi chartered ship. They're believed to be part of a giant Iraqi cannon that was going to lob nuclear or chemical missiles into Israel. Now, Iraq denied it was building a quote-unquote super gun, but after the war it was discovered that Iraq had actually built such a weapon. And since Saddam Hussein had already used chemical weapons against his own Kurdish population in 1988, few Israelis doubted that his willingness to use nuclear weapons against the Jews if he had the opportunity. Now, Israel's concern grew when it found out that Saddam Hussein had long-range Scud missiles capable of delivering chemical weapons into the heart of Israel. In preparation, in Israel at that time, everyone was issued gas masks. Children under a certain age were put in these, like, it was sort of like, I don't know, a plastic bubble. It was like a tiny little playpen that, covered in this plastic that would protect them from chemical weapons. And every Israeli was told that they had to prepare in their house a sealed room. Sealed room meant that you could seal up the windows and the doorway so that no gases would come in. If there would be a missile that landed nearby, you would be able to protect yourself. You'd have your gas mask and you'd be in this room. So we had tape along the windows. We had tape along the doors. We put wet towels underneath the door so that no chemicals should come in. In Neve Daniel, where I lived, I still live, in Neve Daniel, there were only about 20 families that were living in the yeshuv. About 10 had already moved into permanent homes, and another 10 were living in these trailer homes. Now, the trailer homes in Israel called caravans could not be sealed, and therefore every family had like a buddy family. So when a siren went off, the family from the caravan would come into the house and you would all go into the same sealed room. So that first night of the war, I still remember it, we had, turns out, not just two families, but three, because another family that we were friendly with and didn't like their buddy family, because go figure, small yeshuv. We had six adults, I don't know, probably about nine kids, all shoved into one small bedroom. There were kids in those plastic, you know, playpens, everyone sitting there with their gas mask, and we brought a radio in. Now, Israel wasn't broadcasting anything, but one of the women in the room, she was listening to BBC, and they were broadcasting that chemical weapons were dropped on Tel Aviv, talking about the tremendous loss of life, and she was freaking out. She was freaking out because she had parents that were living in the Tel Aviv area. It turns out that none of that actually happened. It turns out that Saddam Hussein never used chemical weapons after the first couple of days. So the families continued to sit, but they stopped coming to our house. Instead, the rabbis of the yeshiva that I was then in, we divide up the guys. I had four guys that were sleeping in my house, and they were coming into the room with us. They lived by us for over a week. Ate us out of house and home. They called themselves the Hungry, Hungry Hippos. And we would go into the room and we would seal it. Now, this was going on. As I said, it turns out afterwards, after about a week, we realized that there was no chemical weapons. And instead, Israel told us to go into bomb shelters because that would be safer from conventional bombs than from chemical weapons. Why didn't Saddam Hussein use chemical weapons if he had the opportunity? Not clear, but it is known that Yitzhak Shamir had let it be known that should chemical weapons be dropped, Israel would retaliate with whatever means it deemed necessary. And since the whole world knew that, the not so well guarded secret that Israel possessed chemical, not just chemical, but nuclear weapons, that's probably helped Saddam Hussein decide not to use chemical weapons towards Israel. Now, what was problematic was, here it is, Israel's being bombed, and the PLO, living in Israel, they're up on their roofs, and they're dancing, and they're singing as missiles are falling into Israel. Okay, they're marching in the streets. There was 1,000 Palestinians who marched in Jenin who were singing, "Saddam, you hero, attack Israel with chemical weapons." Okay, to the point that after the war was finally over, you had Israeli peace activists that were so disappointed. One such activist, Yaron London, he wrote in an article, "This week you proved to me for many years I was a great fool. When you ask once again for my support for your quote-unquote legitimate rights, you discover that your shouts of encouragement to Saddam have clogged my ears." What was interesting about the Gulf War was the miracle that happened. 39 missiles fell in Israel, and no one was killed from a missile. There was tons and tons of damage. Okay, America had actually sent Patriot missiles, anti-missile missiles, to try to intercept. I remember my wife's grandmother, we were speaking to her on the phone, and she didn't always get words correct, and she said, "Oh, it's really good that we in America here were sending you the patriarchs." And I told her, "Nanny, like, we sort of have the patriarchs here, but yeah, I understand the patriots." Now, the Patriot missiles ended up missing almost every time, and the few times that it intercepted, it actually caused more damage because it would smash the missile over city centers where the debris would then cause tons and tons of damage where everything fell. So, but with all of this, no one was killed. There was lots of damage, no one was killed. There were books that were in afterwards, there was amazing stories. You know, there was one story where, this I saw on the news, there was a missile that went through, it's like a two-story building. The bottom floor was a makolet. And here's the missile sticking through the roof. Okay, it goes through the roof. It goes through the second story. It's on the first story where the makolet is. And the missile is standing on the cashier, you know, where the makolet guy had his Sefer Tehillim. And the nose of the missile is sitting on the Sefer Tehillim, and it never exploded. Right? You see the missile, didn't explode, and it's resting on the Sefer Tehillim. A crazy case was that about a week, or maybe it was a month, I don't remember right now, earlier, there was a problem with the gas line in Tel Aviv, and they rerouted the gas to this alternate old pipeline. Okay, that's what they did. And here it is, during the Gulf War, a missile came, smashed into the new pipeline. Had the pipeline had gas, there would have been a tremendous explosion. Who knows how many people would have killed. In the end, it hit an empty gas line, causing no damage. The craziness of the miracles that, when would the war end? It began, as I said, in January. It ended on Purim. Erev Purim, the war ended, and Israelis traded in their gas masks for Purim masks. Unbelievable. Sort of the opposite of this year. This year, we traded in our Purim masks, and then we have the coronavirus and people going and getting, you know, masks from the pharmacy to protect them from the airborne virus. But in 1991, it was crazy. I mean, side benefit for me at that time, there was no satellite, there was no, like, cables. No one, you know, wasn't. It was very difficult to watch any sports. That year, the Giants played in the Super Bowl, and because there were American troops in the area, so the Super Bowl was live all over the Middle East. I got to watch my favorite team, the Giants, win the Super Bowl. It was pretty cool. Now, what happened because of this Gulf War? So President Bush and Secretary of State Baker felt that now the Palestinians and the Jordanians and the Syrians, and most importantly the Israelis, owe them. They stopped this threat in the region. Saddam Hussein, as we said before, the butcher of Baghdad, from wreaking havoc. And therefore, he put pressure on these parties to come to a historic conference in Madrid. November 1st, 1991, Prime Minister Shamir, and you had representatives, as I said, of Syria, Lebanon, and the Palestinians all came. And the push from President Bush was that there should be direct negotiations between the parties that should lead to peace. I remember watching it live on television. The Syrian spokesman, he delivered this speech, a very belligerent speech, demanding that Israel give back every single inch of Golan, of West Bank, of Jerusalem, of Gaza. Doesn't even mention peace. He holds up a picture of Yitzhak Shamir, who we know was in the underground, the Stern Gang, known as the Lehi, and he held up a picture, an old placard from the British Mandate era, wanted, reward, dead or alive, for Yitzhak Shamir, and this is what he held up to say, this is the person you want us to negotiate with. But in the end, the conference, although no major achievements came from it, symbolic achievements did. You had countries that now were sitting at the same table, looking at each other. They later on had another conference in Moscow. There wasn't such, tremendous negotiations between the countries from Madrid, but eventually it did lead to what would eventually be called the Oslo Accord 2 years later. And that we'll speak about some other time.